Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. If you have a question about a bug that may be bugging you, or maybe it's just a bug of interest, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Phil, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
What's the status of the tick population this summer?
Well, it's always hard because it can be very localized as far as where you're seeing problems or not. I guess the thing I would be concerned about if you're an outdoor person is we're getting to that time of the year that people let their guard down, and the deer ticks make this transition in early October from the nymphal stage to the adults. And so there will be ticks, deer ticks out there when you're out and about, at least until the snow comes. Now, in the last few years, we've had a constant slow rise in the number of Lyme disease cases. We have seen somewhat of a steady growth of deer ticks on the eastern side of the state. It's still not anywhere near what is on the western side. So we're seeing some changes going on. But I guess, again, if you're an outdoor person, I would take the precautions. You're out in the woods, consider spraying your pants with permethrin and do tick checks at night just to make sure there's no unpleasant surprises. Now, as far as wood ticks, we don't see them. It's all deer ticks now from midsummer on. That's all we expect.
Okay. So if you have a tick, it's likely it's going to be
a better than a 90% chance that it's going to be a deer tick.
All right. So be on guard. Lots of callers to visit with you. Let's go to Christy in Potosi. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think I have a question about ants.
Okay.
We have a greenhouse attached to our house. It has quite a few wood structural members. I looked out there the other day, and there was this amazing parade of insects, just hundreds and hundreds. Half of them were red ants, about an eighth of an inch long, and the other half were winged things that looked sort of like small houseflies, but I assume they are also ants. They were a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, are these both ants, and are they doing something bad out there?
Definitely both ants. Winged ants are the kings and queens, if you think of them that way, the reproductive ants. And at this time of the year, both cornfield ants, which are a common outdoor lawn ant, and field ants, which we call formica, go through a swarming period. So one of the common calls I'm getting right now are ants just bubbling out of the ground with wings. Now, in your situation, it sounds like the ants were transitioning from one nest to another site. I don't know if this was a satellite colony, which is kind of what they do in the summer, and then go back to the main colony. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
But probably, the ants that we worry about is structural issues. Carpenter ants in particular don't do that, at least this visibly. They do it, but it's usually at night. And so, as I said, I suspect you had an ant colony moving from point A to point B, and I also really don't expect a problem. Now, I'm not positive it's one of those two ants. If they're still active, the first thing I would ask you is send me one, and we can tell what kind of ant it is and then kind of figure out a little bit more where they might likely nest. And secondly, are they going to be an issue, like... Pavement ants will love to come in your kitchen. Field ants will never come in your kitchen.
Uh-huh.
So those are issues that sometimes people want to know about.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks
Christy. Very much.
Yeah, thank you, Christy. Kathy in Columbus, on to you now. Hi, Kath.
Hi, Larry and Phil.
Hi.
Hi. I am calling to get an update on the status of the Asian lady beetles for this year. And I also want to know if you have any information about the insecticide Tempo to treat for the Asian lady beetles.
Okay, we'll start with the Tempo. It is a synthetic pyrethroid called bifenthrin. To be honest, there are formulations of Bug Be Gone that have the same active ingredient, but the formulations sometimes differ, and that's how they make it. The Tempo product, there are some forms that are almost microencapsulated that the pest control people prefer to use because it tends to have a longer residual. But there isn't that much difference between the Bug Be Gones and the Tempos. And to be honest, the other interesting thing is so many of these products now are available to homeowners if they do a little homework on the internet. Sometimes I get a little nervous about some of the things that are accessible to homeowners, but these particular products, as I said, are just different formulations of products that you can buy at any hardware store. Now, the Asian lady beetle, it looks like the numbers are down, but they've been down for the last 2 or 3 years, and we have not had the right conditions to get them to start migrating in yet. It's typically a pretty good hard freeze and then have the nice Indian summer type days, and so we haven't had that trigger, but usually that happens sometime in the next 2 to 3 weeks. But if I had to compare it think about last year, it definitely won't be any worse than last year, and it might even be a little bit better. There's still people, though, that if, you know, I tell people, if you had 100,000 and they're down 80%, you still have 20,000, that may be too many. So there are circumstances, and this would be the time to treat. We usually suggest the last week of September, first week of October for problematic sites is you treat now, because you know that things are going to happen shortly after, and you really need the product on before they start to come in.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Kath. Kathy from Phillips, your turn. Hi, Kath.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The other day, my son was helping me to bring wood down into the basement for the burning season, and he called me over to look at a nice little specimen. I think it might have been a wolf spider, but I don't know anything about them. Are they spinners? Do they have fangs? Do I need to be pursuing this critter? Do I just leave him alone and he'll be fine?
They are smallish to very large hunting spiders. And so they don't make nests. They wander around at night. And so they're not normally an indoor spider, but they do occasionally wander inside and often scare the bejesus out of the people that are inside. The big ones I kind of describe to people as kind of small tarantula-looking creatures.
That's what it looked like.
Yeah. Now, if you were to pick one up and handle it and really bother it, I think it has the opportunity to bite you. The bite wouldn't be anything worse than a bee sting, probably not even that bad, but I dare you to catch one because they're very visual, they're very quick, and so I just don't worry about it. And to be honest, in that environment, one of two things will happen. It will be lucky enough to find its way out and move out, or it will die in relatively short order because that's just not a kind of habitat that will have the kind of food or environment that it would like to stay in.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Kathy. And Ruth in Wausau, we're on to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. We have a green spire linden tree. It's about 25 years old. It has all these little beetles flying around. And about 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, they're really, really proficient, or whatever you want to call it. And now they've kind of slowed down, but I'm wondering, will they hurt the tree?
Okay. I'm guessing it's Japanese beetle. I'm a little surprised they've hung out quite this late because this usually starts about the 1st of July and starts to wind down the first week of September. The feeding damage is cosmetic. They love to start at the top of the tree and kind of work down, and in areas where they are very bad, the whole tree can be stripped by mid-August. And we know they continue to move north. We started to see some significant populations as high as Barron County this year, which was a new one on Phil's record book. So Wausau doesn't surprise me at all. You know, what your options are is you can let it be in the tree. We'll just do fine, but I expect this will be an annual occurrence from now on in. Birches, lindens, some of the purple leaf plums, some of the cherries are high on their list. And the option then is to use one of these systemic insecticides. And Bayer has one out they call their tree and shrub insecticide. And now Fertilome is marketing the same product as their tree and shrub drench. That's what it is. You mix it in a bucket of water. You put so much product on per inch diameter of tree.
Could I write that down? Would you say that again?
Bayer, the people that make the aspirin, B-A-Y-E-R's, tree and shrub insecticide.
Okay, tree and shrub insecticide. Okay.
And as I said, you don't need any equipment other than a bucket, but what I would suggest that you apply this the early part of May would be a good time because it gives it time to get into the tree roots and up into the tree leaves. And very large trees are a little harder to treat. And if anything, I would treat earlier rather than later on big trees. Small trees, you can sometimes get away even with treating mid-June. But it will make a significant difference and keep the leaves on the tree. Now, unfortunately, there's other things in the landscape. I mean, they go after cotoneasters, roses, potentillas. I mean, it's a long list of things. And as I have known before this even showed up in the state, this would be the most miserable bug for me to deal with on a day-to-day basis for homeowners because there's so little you can do permanent. They're not breeding in your lawn. They're flying in from elsewhere. And, you know, they're out there for 2 months. And so, as I said, we can do some things, but it's still a bug that's not fun to have around.
Okay, so if we treat it with the systemic, it's a root system type thing, correct?
Right.
Will that get rid of them, or if we don't, will they come back? Will they hurt the tree?
Well, no, they will never hurt the tree.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. There's quite a few leaves that are turning yellow and falling off.
Right. Although this is about the time.
It's about the time when
time
they would
it happens anyway. In birch trees, when they do this heavily, this happens by the end of July, and the ground is littered with it, and the trees do relatively fine. You know, for birch trees, I tell people I'd be more concerned about watering it in dry spells, just because that gets weak for other problems. But the Japanese beetle feeding really is cosmetic on all these plants.
One other question, a real quick one here. A cherry tree, sour cherry tree, it's half dead. It has like green moss on the outside and so on, and it's kind of split. Is there any way to keep it alive, or is it just best to chop it down and start over?
Well, I mean, the tree has its own defenses. It's a question of what's killing it. My guess, it's more likely a disease than an insect. But you have to look at the trunk. I mean, there are some borers that get in there, so you have to look for holes. So I think you really have to figure more what you got. If it's an insect, you've got a chance of putting up a fight. If it's a disease, the tree has a chance of walling this off. But what will tell you more than anything, I'm guessing, is how the tree looks next spring. If it continues to decline and show dieback, I think you've lost it. But I would give it till that time. I mean, just kind of wait and see. Some of these diseases are just so aggressive the tree has no chance, but in some cases they do wall it off and can kind of callus that tissue over and keep growing.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to Jerry in Big Bend next. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a small bug in the house that we've never had before. It flies, and if you try to squash it, it has sort of a hard shell, so you almost need your fingernail. Now, we went through a spice cabinet yesterday, and we found quite a few in there. And also, in the breadcrumb container, which is cardboard with a plastic cap on, there were quite a few in there, and how they ever got in there, or maybe if that's where they started.
Yeah, it sounds like a drugstore beetle. It's one of the few insects that get into food products that fly. And it is very aggressive on spices and starch-based things, noodles, rice, chocolate, very common in pet food. And the problem is that a lot of our packaging is not substantial enough. These come from a family of beetles that are really wood borers that can burrow through 2 inches of oak. And so a little piece of cardboard isn't a whole lot to stop them. And so what I suggest to folks is you go through things. And again, pay particular attention to your spices, which is something that people often wouldn't think about. Throw out what's infested, what's not infested, that you're going to have around for a period of time. You can either throw in the freezer, you can put into screw-top glass jars or substantial packaging like, you know, Tupperware or some of these other heavy plastic things that have tight-fitting lids. This way, the insects can't get through it. If you miss something, you keep them confined. They can't get out. What happens with some of these insects, too, is they can lay their eggs and the very tiny larvae are small enough to get through seams. And so, again, cardboard boxes often don't keep them out. Undoubtedly, you brought it in from the grocery store. It's just sometimes hard to trace what that was. But other than that, as I said, it's a food pest. It's a pet food pest. But you watch out for dried flower arrangements. I mean, they could get into something like that, potentially. Anything that's plant-based, even vegetable, dried vegetable seeds, if they had an opportunity, they could potentially breed in that.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Okay, and we found some in sealed baggies. Now, is there any way to get rid of them, or... Can they chew in? I mean, into the wood in the cabinet?
No, I wouldn't worry about that.
Okay.
You know, it basically, you know, the whole trick to this one is finding what they're in and getting rid of it and preventing them from doing an end run. What I always tell people as far as sprays, I mean, you could spray your counter, but the problem is you got to pull all the dishware out, you spray it, and then it dries, and you put the goods back in. And I tell people, you know, if you got a bad box of Bisquick, you can do all the spraying you want. You haven't solved anything, and so I don't find it to be a productive use of your time. I find it much more productive to just kind of sort through things. Sometimes with this particular insect, it will look like BB-sized round holes, either in the packaging or the goods themselves. And that's characteristic of some of these wood borers. So if I see little holes drilled in the cardboard, I know for sure those little stinkers. And usually what you're seeing are them coming out rather than going in, to be honest.
Yeah. Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. If you have a question about a bug, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And June in Arborvita is up next with a question. Hi, June.
Hi, Larry and Phil and Jim, too. I'm just looking outside, and it's really a strong, windy day, and I'm wondering if that will help me. I have poinsettia and fuchsias that are infested with white flies. They've spent the summer out on the deck and appear to be happy, and they look okay. But the white flies are there, and I'd really rather not use pesticides before I bring them in the house. Should I just toss them, or is there something that I can do to make them safe to bring in?
Well, I think what you're facing is potentially a moderate challenge. White flies are one of the more difficult critters to deal with, and if you were to inclined to use sprays, there is an insecticidal soap that you could spray on the plants, but I will tell you that you're going to have to put it on at least three times with a five-day interval in between and get very good coverage to have any chance to get these things under control. And so, as I said, it's a lot of maintenance.
Is that safer soap?
Yes, safer soap would be an option. And now, another thing you could consider, although I'll warn you that this one, I think, too, has a little bit of a loophole. The same Bayer product that we were talking about earlier that people can drench on, I have seen in some of the garden stores that they have little plant capsules for doing houseplants. The same thing. It's a systemic insecticide. You put this into the soil, and it's uptaken by the plant. It will slow the white flies down considerably. But one of the things you find in systemics and in houseplants in particular is that it's very actively going to the actively growing tissue and doesn't do near as well in the older tissue, which allows some of the white flies to survive. So what you often see is you think you're winning and things are going real well for a couple months, and all of a sudden they explode again, which tells me we've gotten to the point that the systemic has went away. Now, the nice thing about that is it's contained. It's only found in the plant sap, so you're not spraying the stuff around. So that would be another option. As long as you realize its limitations, I don't expect it to eliminate, but it will very much reduce the populations of white flies.
All right.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. I didn't have any hope at all, and these are mature plants. The poinsettia particularly, it has a woody stem, so I would have to do it more frequently then probably.
Well, you just kind of watch for signs of activity on any new growth. It kind of tells you if you're winning or losing here, because some of the whitefly bodies per se, or they make these little capsule-like things when they transform from the nymphal stage, will still stay on the plant. Now, it's interesting, the number of whiteflies on an individual leaf has to approach 100 or so before you start to see symptoms on the plant. So the plants are really quite tolerant. But as I said, on the other hand, I consider this a real stinker of an insect. And if you can at all help from getting it, bring it in the house, because if you've got other plants that are susceptible, but fuchsia and poinsettia are on the top of the list. They love those plants.
Good luck. Thank you, June, for calling. Appreciate it very much. And we'll turn next to Heather in Brookston, Minnesota. Heather, hi.
Good morning, Phil and Larry. Boy, I couldn't ask for you any sooner to be on the air. On Saturday morning, I have double doors leading out of a cabin that I live in. It's just one story. There was a spider coming down in front of the window door that doesn't open that was so big that I think probably from tip of toe to tip of toe, it may have been 2 3/4 across. And, of course, scared me to death. It was dropping down on its string and waving its arms at me, legs at me. I smashed it too quickly. I'm a photographer, and I normally would catch something like that, but it was bigger than I was expecting. I'm not afraid of spiders, but this one has my hands still shaking when I think about it. But I'm sure you know what it is. I want to know about its habits. I don't know what it was. It was mostly black, but it did have white bands, maybe 2 or 3 on each leg.
Okay. Well, the striping in the leg, I'm suspicious. The spider that I think gives the most fear, we talked earlier about wool spiders being big, but there is a group rather closely related we call fishing spiders. The genus is Dolomedes, but they don't necessarily have to be right on the water. You will see them on piers, but you also see them good distances away.
Yeah, I'm up on a hill away from water, yeah.
Yeah, but like the wolf spider, they're nighttime hunting spiders, and they're out cruising around and show up in all kinds of places. And as I said, one of the distinctive things is they have a very distinctive banding on their legs.
So it was.
Pattern. And, nothing really dangerous about it. It's interesting because in general we associate generally the bigger spiders as being the ones that scare people the most, but they're really relatively speaking, more harmless. It's some of the littler spiders that we sometimes have issues with.
Right. I'm not afraid of the bite. The thing was so big, it was like having a monster at the door.
Yeah. And again, they're very visual, and they have to keep moving. You know, I almost think of them as kind of lions of the spider world, because that's kind of what they're doing, is out, you know, chasing down their prey. In fact, in the case of wool spiders, and I'm not sure about dolomites, but some of the related nursery web spiders, the females carry their young on their back. You know, and cart them around when they're real small, which is kind of interesting. Or the same with their egg sac. They carry that around. So you sometimes see these spiders with what looks like a ping pong ball that they're carrying around, and it's that's their egg sac.
Interesting. Thanks, Heather.
Do they live indoors or outdoors in the winter? I mean, the reason I'm asking, are there hundreds if there's one?
No. They're few and far between, you know, being kind of high on the food chain here in the insect world. I don't think there's a lot of food to keep them going, and they're just not an indoor spider. As I said, they will wander in. In fact, the thing I talk to people, if they see two or three in the fall, which I consider pretty impressive numbers indoors, I talk more about what can be sealed, what kind of vents can be screened to physically keep them out, rather than, again, they did this on purpose, and I just don't see them breeding.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Heather. Thanks a lot for calling. No, not to worry. Chris in Wauwatosa, it's your turn now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I took my fiancée down to Indiana, where I'd grown up, for the first time this summer, and she'd asked me at one point in an early August afternoon, what was that deafening buzz? And I had to stop and think about what she was talking about and realized it was cicadas, and then I realized I'm not used to hearing them up here, and I was kind of curious. We heard them just in countless numbers every summer throughout Indiana, but up here it seems to be a rarity, and I was kind of curious about that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, no, we do have a very common species of dog day cicada, but there are different species south of us that have different calls. The one that I love, they call the scissor grinder. And it's interesting because it's, you know, I again recognize when I'm traveling, you get into areas and they just seem to be twice as loud. And the scissor grinder in particular is a call that goes up and down quite a bit. So it goes, whereas the cicadas we have a more constant chime. And so it depends where you're located, but as I said, I find cicadas are pretty widespread. In fact, we literally have 9 common species that have been found in the state, but this dog day cicada, the Tibbacine lineatus that we have up here, is the most common one. So as I said, you may be associating just a different species with a different call, but definitely we have them here.
We're sorry.
Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Ron in Newburgh next. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, fellows. Did we muck up the environment again, or was it all a rain this spring? I have virtually no yellow jackets, which is good for picking the grapes pretty soon.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen a single box elder bug.
Okay. Well, the two parts of it, the rains definitely are tough on box elder bugs. It promotes a fungus disease. And so generally, very dry falls, I expect lots of complaints. And when we have sufficient rains, they're not much of an issue. The yellow jacket one, I think, is getting more involved. Dr. Bob Jean in our department works with yellow jackets and studies their behavior with his students. And boy, the German yellow jacket, which is the one that goes after the grapes most commonly and also garbage, has been almost non-existent. I don't remember a year in my career where I've had so few complaints at farmers markets and picnics and all these kinds of things. Is in a bad year, by the 1st of August, you can't eat outdoors without these things showing up and wrestling you for your food. And boy, now it just isn't there.
They're not there.
And we're suspicious, to be honest. I'm talking to Dr. Jean about this, is that there may indeed be some disease issues. Now, German yellow jacket is not a native, but it has been in our state for about 4 decades. But it has been really, the last 3 or 4 years, their numbers have been dramatically down. And that's for the good, because, to be honest, in the years that they're very bad, you know, I'll have emergency rooms call me and say that a third of the people walking in have, quote, bee stings, but what they are yellow jacket stings.
Oh. So there you have it, Ron.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Janet in Hubertus, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hello. We went away for a few months during the winter, and when we came home, we had a huge spider web problem in our basement. And despite my efforts with vacuums, this hoses on, it continues. Before we left, it had started, and we used a Raid fumigator before we left, right before we left, and hoped that would calm it down, but they seem to have succeeded in multiplying again. We don't see the spiders often, but the webs are everywhere in the basement, and they're starting to come upstairs, and it's getting scary.
Okay.
How can I get rid of them without leaving the house or getting my cats out? My cats are indoor cats, and I'm afraid of making them sick.
Yeah, I honestly still think the vacuum is probably as good a way of going about it as any, but make sure you've got one of these attachments that you can get back into the corners and crevices, because then you're going to be capturing many of the spiders that are doing this, rather than just worrying about getting down the webbing. In general, I don't have a lot of faith in any kind of bombs for spiders, both because of the pesticide that's involved. What we find with some spiders, it's almost better to go with a powdered-like spray or a dust, although the powder might be a little easier to work with, because it will coat the nest much better, and then when the spiders are active in the nest, it takes care of them. But as I said, for most people, I tend to find, you know, two times, three times a year, go out there and just get back in every corner you can think of, and you'll probably get as good an effect out of that than any spray we can come up with.
Okay, with the dust or powder, what kind of applicator is on that product?
Well, you know, there are some wettable powders that are sold that you mix with water and spray it just like you would any other spray, but you need some kind of sprayer. Or in the other case, you use a duster, which is, you know, much like the dust that you use out on your vegetables plant sometimes. But what I would say is people tend to overdust. You know, you just need a very light amount of this product. And there are some pyrethroid insecticides like deltamethrin and whatnot that really are pretty good spider products. It takes a little bit of running around to find these products. But again, as we talked about earlier, there are these do-your-own sites that you can get on the internet and look over the kind of applicators they'll have, or also the pesticides they have. So if your local hardware store doesn't have the thing, there are ways you can get this stuff shipped to you. And that would be the direction I'd go.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Janet. Kirk in Broadhead, on to you now. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We live in an old farmhouse, 1880s, and in the basement, a lot of the floor joists and a lot of the sill is dry rot and kind of crumbly. And I just always assume that's what it was, is they're old and they're dry rotten. And we were looking to replace them eventually, maybe next spring or something. But this fall, we were re-roofing our roof, and we found a lot of groups of, they look like ants, except they've got wings. And I guess I'm just wondering, are those some form of carpenter's ant, or they don't really seem to chew the wood or anything, but there were quite a few colonies of them underneath our shingles.
Sure. Well, I think there's two things going on. The dry rot, I think you're right. You probably had some powder post beetle in there also. The characteristic is you have almost talcum powder-like debris getting in within the wood, and also, if you look very carefully, small round holes. But very often what I find in these old structures is the powder post beetles died out on their own long ago. And it's the combination of the moisture and whatnot that eventually gets you into some structural issues. Now, as far as carpenter ants, they will love to nest in wood that is compromised. So often we'll see them, if you've had a leaky problem in the roof and the wood starts to soften, they'll get into it. But they don't have to. They often nest even in voids and spaces and the like. And so I would not be surprised at all if they were carpenter ants up there. But so often what we always tell people, I don't worry about carpenter ants eating your house and having it fall down. As a homeowner, what you worry about is moisture issues and the kind of problems that can present. And so when you do find the nests like you did, you can spot treat them with just a little, any aerosol ant spray you can pick up at the hardware store and you're done. I mean, there's no important thing to do. And again, probably what you had is some well-weathered wood or an environment that they wanted to move into, but I don't think it's related to what was going on in the basement.
Okay.
When you get carpenter ants in wood, the sawdust, rather than being like talcum powder, is a coarser sawdust, and there's often debris mixed with it. And sometimes we see that residue on somebody's washing machine, then I know they're up in the joists above that point. Uh-huh. And usually when you look at it, you see, well, this has had some water problems in the past. It started to kind of get punky and soft, and that's what the ants move into, because in nature they're living in rotting stumps. So that's what the kind of environment they're looking for in your house.
Okay.
All right.
Wait, and real quick, if I may ask, this morning in our parking lot, we found a praying mantis.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think they were all that uncommon, but everyone else said they had never seen one. Okay. Well, how uncommon are they?
Well, two issues. We have no native mantids in Wisconsin, and typically the mantids people find are either the European or the Chinese mantids. And although people can buy these egg sacs and raise them, you can get these in garden catalogs. What we've used to experience is that when the cold weather came and they laid their eggs, the eggs would freeze out. They did not survive our winters. But we have been convinced in the last 5 or 6 years that we do have breeding populations in the state now. And I think it, again, is a fact that we are having warmer winters and we're seeing some of these, quote, more southern creatures take hold. So I think the people are right. They're not overly common. And they used to die out. Usually somebody would have had to bring them in to your area to see them in a given year. But now we do know we have breeding populations and they are slowly spreading in the southern third of the state. Which reminds me, I got a very interesting, you know, people send me pictures all the time and on Monday, and usually Mondays are lots of fun because people have all weekend to take pictures. But I was sent a picture of a walking stick taken up in Devil's Lake. And what was unique about it, other than being about 4 inches long, which is a smidgen longer than our normal ones, it had two very distinct red lines down its back. And so I was off to the museum upstairs and looking, and it turns out to be a species that is endemic to the United States called the giant walking stick. And the normal range for this is Iowa South. So we don't normally see it, but we had two specimens in the collection, one identified. Now this picture, all three from Devil's Lake. Only place it's been found in the state. It's kind of like a remnant population. And so it made my Monday. That was, you know, kind of an interesting thing to see, but we are seeing a change, you know, of things moving in here. And again, I equate it a lot to just not having significant real cold 30 below type temperatures that would often keep some of these things out.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Kirk.
Thank you.
And Mike in Milwaukee, we're on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I'm calling is I've lost about 5 or 6 mature white oak trees on my property, and the remaining 3 are not looking good. I had a tree service out, and they said what I have is 2-line borer infection in them, and I'm wondering about controlling and treating for that.
Well, you know, we have seen an awful lot. I mean, the two things that kill oak trees typically in this state, other than construction damage that sets them up, is oak wilt and 2-line chestnut borer. Now, oak wilt is a disease that moves through, and generally burrs and white oaks have less trouble than the reds and black oaks with it, but they still could potentially have it. So anytime you have the dead trees, it is good to get an arborist in there to figure out which of the two you've got.
Uh-huh.
I saw a ton of chestnut borer going crazy the last 3 or 4 years because of the significant summer droughts. You know, they take advantage of stress trees, and they will kill them. And so life was absolutely terrible until last August in our area, where we got 15 inches of rain, and then we had a good winter for moisture and a pretty good spring. And so in a lot of cases, I see trees able to literally grow past chestnut borer if they're strong and healthy and have sufficient moisture. But it sounds like your trees just didn't get that lucky to get the moisture early enough. And so the option right now is the same chemicals that they're using for emerald ash borer, the same chemical they're using for bronze birch borer, is they're using systemics, this imidacloprid, as a drench. They sometimes also will play around with some injectable chemicals, Bidrin in particular. And what they're doing is trying to force the insecticide into the tree, into the vascular tissue, where that's where the chestnut borers are going. I would tell you that in the long run, keeping the tree watered if it gets very dry is as important, if not more important, than the chemical. The second question is, the arborist should be able to give you some feel. If there's a lot of dieback in the tree, the concern is that the insects are wrecking the vascular system. If the vascular system is wrecked, you can't move the chemical, because that's what you need is to have things intact. And so there are trees that have enough problems on them that it's just not reasonable to consider putting the expense of treating. But for high-value trees, and I will tell you that I have had probably more complaints in the southeast part of the state, Milwaukee, Waukesha, and whatnot, of, again, mature 200-year-old trees under a lot of stress and dying, and I know it's chestnut borer. In the long run, the best news is the moisture levels. As I said, the trees are getting stronger, but if you've got trees that are showing that much decline, as I said, I think it's worth talking about, because there are positive effects from doing these treatments.
All right.
Is this a good time of year to apply those insecticides?
Spring, to be honest, is an easier time for the tree to take it up. But it isn't all that critical right now for this one, because it eventually gets up there anyway. And that's the question. So, it's six of one, half a dozen the other. They tell you not to put the stuff on when the ground's frozen because you're not going to move product.
Right.
But I don't think there's going to be that much difference. The insects are going to be inactive all winter long. So it really isn't that much difference right now if you apply it this fall or next spring.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Mike. Melissa in Iron Ridge, we're on to you now. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. I have a question about Asian lady beetles.
Okay.
My husband and I live in a log home, and we think that maybe they are possibly hibernating in the logs.
That's what they do, yes.
We have just, we're inundated with them. They cover the south and the west side of our home.
Has this happened already this year?
Yeah, I'm already starting to see them. Today they're not so bad, but about 4 days ago.
Okay, and did you have a frost up your way?
No, not that I know of.
I'm just a little surprised because, again, watching this, I mean, this thing came in the state back in the early 90s, and typically, I can tell, I learn from experience because when it really first hit the fan, to be honest, I don't think I've ever had, I had so many phone calls, I couldn't put my phone down for like a day and a half because people are getting the same experience. But when this happens, again, can vary from as early as the last couple of days of September to as late as Halloween. I've seen it that late before they exploded, but it's always been this triggering. But going back, you got it right. They particularly, this is a visual insect. It likes south side. It likes visual contrast. And so that's why it likes sunny days where you have both the shade and the sun that kind of draws them in like a magnet. And the more exposed your structure is, the more problems you have.
Mm-hmm.
The worst of it is that they crawl up underneath things. And in some cases, in new construction where they've got Tyvek, they get up under the siding, but they can't get in the house. They will be packed so tight in there, you couldn't push another beetle into the siding.
That's how my skylights are. I vacuum them up by the thousands.
Okay.
And I heard you say not too long ago that your numbers were down last year. I was going to tell you they're all at my house.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. Where we go, our kind of early warning is to walk the soybean fields because this insect is a major predator of soybean aphid.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just not seeing them. I mean, and this has been the second year in a row, but you do get these localized things. And as I told people, I mean, when I'm excited about the numbers being way down is kind of relative to where your setting is. And I think it's very important. If you're going to put up a fight, do it now. I mean,
okay.
Get the chemical on. And they're basically using synthetic pyrethroids, which are the same chemicals that we have used in barns for fly control for years. They have now become the dominant insecticide. When you go to Farm and Fleet and Home Depot and whatnot, 90% of what's on the shelf is one of these products. It's either going to be bifenthrin, permethrin, deltamethrin.
Okay. And do these products work?
Oh, very well.
Okay. I'm not sure what exactly I have to do here, but I think it's contributed to my asthma being recurrent. And
when they
land on me, I get a welt on my skin.
Oh, no. People have developed great sensitivities to these things. And part of it is, as you know, when you disturb the beetles, they exude a protein through their body joints as a defensive mechanism. And so you've got all this strange protein in your house, and people are developing significant allergies to them. So, yes, I think it would be well worth whether you get a commercial person to come in and spray, or if it's, this is a one story, you can spray it easily yourself. And I would spray all along the overhangs, all along the high areas. I don't worry, the bottom couple feet of the structure, all around window frames, all around door frames.
Okay.
And make sure that any vents that you've got are screened with a small enough screen mesh that they can't squeeze through there. It sounds like they're getting access to your attic space or any space you have up above to be coming down through your light fixtures.
I thought maybe they were going up that way.
I'm guessing more
down here by the door.
Yeah. Usually you can tell because there's a plate up in the ceiling. If they're congregated in that plate, they're coming from on top. If they're just accumulating in the glass bowl of the fixture itself, during the day or the night, they're attracted to light. In fact, people will sell light traps for that reason, for Asian lady beetle control. But my argument is you don't let them get in the house in the first place.
Right.
And so, as I said, these pyrethroids will also have a repellency. They won't want to land on the surface, but if they do land on the surface, it will kill them before they get an opportunity to get in.
So would you spray the inside and the outside of the house?
No, I think just the outside.
Just the outside?
Yes.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you for your help.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call or email with your question. The number is 1-800-642-1234. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And let's move on now to Justin, in Winona. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently became obsessed with trout fishing in the Driftless area, and in an effort to become better at it, I have ordered Hatches 2, which is an entomology book about the mayfly, and I was curious if the guest had any information on where I might be able to get samples of the species, or if there's another resource that would help me learn the different subspecies, and especially the nymphs and the...
Well, there are a number of books on aquatic entomology. Bill Hilsenhoff in our department, who was our aquatic entomologist, did Aquatic Insects of Wisconsin, and it was in print with the DNR, but I don't know if it still is or not, but you might check with the Wisconsin DNR, and it's just basically a hand guide. Although what this will force you to do a little bit is to become a bit of an entomologist, because you know, you have to learn the insect structures and whatnot to run the things through the keys. But basically, he has a listing of all the genera in whatnot of mayflies, stoneflies, caddisflies, and whatnot that we see. So that's there are a number of those kind of books. Rich Merritt out of Michigan State has a book on aquatic entomology. So those would be the kind of books I think you need, is an aquatic entomology book for the Midwest. Would get you to the kind of detail that you need. But as I said, it may be more than you want to know, because you're going to be counting the leg segments and the, you know, the hairs on the prothorax and whatnot to identify some of these things.
Sure. So is there any place that you can actually order samples of each different stage of each different species? I mean, is that something that I'm only going to find in a university setting?
Yeah, probably. I don't know anybody, just because there are really so many species involved. But part of it is, you know, once you get used to being able, at least to me, the basics, separating a stonefly from a mayfly, and then see the various, you know, there are some very small mayflies like the beaded's, and there's the great big ones like the ephemerellas. I honestly think if you spend a little time on the internet and whatnot, you might be able to get a pretty good handle of this without getting into that kind of technical detail. As I said, kind of look up some of these things and see both some of the diversity that's involved in the size ranges. I do know that people that fish trout have taken this to a whole new level, and a lot of people have put out books, again, to help trout fishermen figure out what's up, you know, and what's moving. In many cases, I don't think it's important you know the exact species or scientific name of the critter, but you start to get a feel again of you know, the beaded's are hatching in the end of July, you know, in quiet nights, those kind of things. You start to pick up on that, and I think you'll probably be as far ahead.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yeah. Good luck with the fishing, Justin. Thank you. Mary in Ontario is next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, fellas. I have a problem. I have yellow jackets in my wall, and I'm wondering, will they just die and freeze and die, or do I have to...
No, they will die out on their own.
They
starve out is what we think goes on, because they can't go out and forage for food. So usually by the 1st of November, we're okay. And, you know, if you've gone this far and not had trouble with them, usually they're in a site that isn't important. I've been getting most of my calls for about the last 5 or 6 weeks, if the nest is just outside, you know, the cement slab in the front door, we got to do something about it. And, you know, in those cases, I like to go with dusts in the late evening. But, if it's a place away from, you know, pet traffic and people traffic, not to worry. They don't reuse the nests. They won't come back, per se. What they're looking for are gopher burrows or other kind of sheltered sites, because they're not the best diggers themselves, but they can utilize pre-existing holes. So, you know, if you've got an old rabbit burrow in the backyard, before next 1st of June, I would fill it in, just because if a queen finds that next year, she's potentially, you know, going to start a nest, and then people find out about it about the middle of August when they're mowing the lawn and they run over it. So,
well, yeah, these are like in a wall and under in an eave kind of, and they'll just freeze and die, right?
Right.
Yes. And the only mistake I find people make is if they do have one going in their house, you know, into a wall vent or whatnot, do not plug it up until they're taken care of.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times you can just let them be, as I said, as long as they're not coming in. But if you do plug it up, then we've got problems, because often they will find a way of getting in the house proper, and they're quite agitated. And so, unfortunately, in a lot of those cases, I have to tell people to go out there and pull the caulk off so that they can get their outside access again.
Yeah, well, mine had a little access inside the house, but I plugged that up. But they're in and out from the outside, and so mm-hmm. I can just leave them be until it.
Yep, right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling, Mary. And Art, we're on to you now in Madison. Hi, Art.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to get some hawk moths, the caterpillars, but I understand they feed on tomatoes. And my wife said that the neighbors would get angry if my caterpillars ate up their heirloom tomatoes. So I was just curious if I did get some, how much they would migrate, or if they would, you know, spread throughout the neighborhood.
Well, we have hawk, you know, first of all, there are a number of species. We usually talk about the tomato and tobacco hornworms, which are the ones you do find on tomatoes. But there's a number of other species that you get on ash trees and grapes and whatnot. As far as the tomato hornworms, I wouldn't worry about it. If you want to raise them yourself, that's fine, you know, and sacrifice a couple tomato plants for them. But I don't find them to be that contagious per se. As I said, if your neighbor two doors down got some caterpillars, I could easily argue they're just wild ones that flew in and had nothing to do with what you've got.
Okay. Pick them off and save them too, right?
Right, right.
Yep.
Okay, can I ask one more quick question?
Sure.
I noticed by my back steps that there's like a pencil-sized diameter hole, and then later that afternoon it was filled up. I was curious if that was like a burrowing bee or something that maybe.
Yeah, that's, you know, whether we had a lot of cicada killers this year, which is a very large wasp-like creature that paralyzes cicadas, and it digs a hole, boy, the size of a quarter, and drops the cicada down, and eventually that will fill in. But there are numerous other things. We've had a lot of wasps, the cricket hunters, for example, mm-hmm. middle to large blackish wasps that go out and do the same thing. They sting a cricket or a katydid, drag it into a hole and drop it in and lay their egg, and then their grub is on its own. And so we call these solitary type wasps. And the general rule of solitary wasps is they're docile. There's no real nest per se, and if there's no nest, they don't really get very aggressive.
All right. Thanks again for calling, Art. And Scott in Eau Claire, it is your turn. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Log cabin, cut my own wood. Got powder post beetles in my maple. What can I do about it?
In the firewood or in the wood of the
no,
cabin?
No, in finished, you know, like 1x6s.
Okay.
It's been 5 years and still there.
Okay. Is the wood now finished, or is it still rough sawed?
Rough sawed.
Good. There is two or three formulations of boric acid. In fact, technically what they're selling you is something that's called sodium octaborate, which is just a different chemical form. Sold under the name Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, is one commercial name. Another one is Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E. One's liquid-based, the Timbor is powder-based, but in either case, you mix it with water. You paint this on or lightly spray. You don't have to soak. Lightly spray onto the wood. The borates diffuse into the wood, and they are stomach poisons. And so when the powder post beetles come to the surface and eat it, they die. And, you know, for inside exposure, It's pretty much a permanent treatment. It doesn't go away.
What time of year?
Anytime, really. Just okay. When you don't want things to freeze. If I had to pick the optimum time as far as activity, it's the spring, but it doesn't matter in this case.
Can I just take regular boric acid?
It will not penetrate as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, good luck. Thanks again for calling. That's a fairly easy fix. Bob in Minocqua, we're on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Morning. Yeah, I guess. We've had carpenter ants and powder post beetles in the past in a 100-year-old cabin up in this country. And the commercial sprayers that we've hired have seemingly gotten rid of those two problems. But now we've got what I have heard called book beetles. They're just tiny little bugs. And they don't seem to be doing any harm, except they're all over everything, inside, outside. And the commercial sprayer up here says that there's nothing they use that will get rid of them, and they're just taking over where everything else used to be. Is there anything that can control those?
I don't know what a book beetle is. There is a critter called a book louse, which is a little tiny soft-bodied creature that looks like a head louse. That's where it gets a name, but it's not a biting creature. And it gets the name also from the fact that it's in areas with poor ventilation and humidity because it's feeding on the mildew that grows.
Well, that's entirely possible.
But I would offer, if you can catch a couple of those critters, it's bothersome that they're outside. I mean, because if you get the environment inside, you normally wouldn't expect a similar environment outside. So what I think is either if you can take a good digital image, that would be fine. Or if not, catch some, send them down to me at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the College of Ag. Our address is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive. Madison Zip is 53706. And see what you got, because, you know, for all critters, we don't have sprays for everything, but it's either a spray or an environmental adjustment. One of the two, there's got to be something you do to deal with this.
Oh, they seem to exist just about everywhere, and they're not a beetle as such. That was probably a misnomer, because they do seem to be a soft-bodied little thing, and you can squash them with your finger.
Yeah,
They're extremely small. Maybe they are those.
Okay, the book lights. But then, as I said, what I would look at is ways of getting better airflow and ventilation, because I would even be a little concerned, to be honest, that you've got some moisture issues in the roof or the walls, because that would support this kind of thing and, you know, give them the mildew to feed on for them to thrive. What's interesting is usually if you put down any kind of indoor spray, including the ant sprays, you can get a knockdown. You can get an improvement over time. But if the environment doesn't change, they come back. And that may be where the pest control person is saying is that, you know, we can help you in the short run, but they should point out that there are some things that you should be able to do in the long run. It would be basically getting things dried out.
They seem to exist both before and after the sprayer comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then I would really suspect that he's not spraying the right spot.
Oh.
You know, that they're coming from a place, and again, that would go back to the wet walls or wet ceiling and spilling out from there. I think this takes a little bit more digging on this one, because there should be something that could be done that improves things dramatically.
And thanks very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Robert in Stevens Point's been waiting a long time, Phil, so let's go to Robert. Robert, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a problem with a house we purchased in Mexico. It's about 500 miles south of the Arizona border. It's a house constructed of concrete and brick, fortunately. However, the built-ins, the cabinets, the trim around the windows, seem to be infested with what I assume are termites. I've been ripping things out and removing whatever seems to be infested. I wonder if there would be some sort of another way I could control them.
Well, I don't know which kind of termite you have, and unfortunately there are far more different species in the southern climates. And we just have subterraneans here, but they have dry wood termites and other things. And in those climates, to be honest, in some of these circumstances, they come in and fumigate. They put a big tent over the house and pump it full of toxic gas to kill out the termites that are there. The problem is there's just not necessarily outward signs that they're in the wood. And so that's the only way they can guarantee you that you're killing everything off. So as I said, you know, without seeing the termites, I'm a little handcuffed, because you treat dry wood termites different than you do subterranean termites, and there are wet wood termites, and as I said, there really is a number of groups that we don't normally run into up here.
These would be dry wood, I'm sure.
Okay, well then, as I said, the standard method, if you know they're in a particular spot, you can drill a hole and spot treat it with various pesticides, but if it's a widespread thing, they tend to tent fumigate.
I see. What pesticide might you recommend
for
drilling a hole and introducing that?
What you're going to find is a lot of that are pyrethroids now, so things like delta methrin and lambda cyhalothrin.
You need to really know though what you're dealing with,
yeah,
for sure.
But they're not a whole lot different than the ant sprays, to be honest. It's how you apply it. In this case, again, you need to have some kind of small hole drilled so that you can put the nozzle in and get the penetration that you need.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I had an email from Brant, who had a wild honeybee hive under an old grapevine, and in the last week the bees have gone from a volleyball size to a yellow cone 6 inches long with maybe 30 bees. What's happening?
Well, I think most of them left in as a swarm, which probably is for the better, because if you know, you do get these exposed honeybee nests at times, but it's an awful tough to get through the winter. So I suspect that a good portion of the colony has moved off to a hollow tree or some other more sheltered site, and the other bees will try. But for that few of bees, that there's no way that they could survive a winter being that weak. But you do see bees do this. You know, typically it's much earlier in the season we get the swarms. But and the one thing I'm somewhat encouraged is that in the last 3 or 4 years, I get a lot more calls about swarms, which tell me the bees are doing better.
That's good.
In this area.
Here's one from Marion, who says, my dog was diagnosed with mites. We treat her for it, but want to know how she got it and how to be sure it's gone from our house. So
yeah,
maybe something about the life cycle.
She was, I had seen the email, and she's talking about Chelyellid mites, which are fur mites. And what's interesting about it, on the dog, they often don't pose much more than a dandruff or dry skin-like reaction. But I find people get bites from these things, and they are significant bites. And it's sometimes so hard to correlate what you're getting bit from, but that's one of the first things I ask people. Do you have a pet? Does it show discomfort? The mites don't do well off the host. So the most important thing is treating the dog. I guess I would say in cases if the dog has some bedding and whatnot, if you could wash that or dispose of it, that would take care of it. You know, blankets, those kind of things. The mites will not survive washing. Other than that, general vacuum cleaning would go a long way. So it's not something like your whole house is overrun with it, because as I said, the mites really have to live on the dog to be able to sustain themselves.
Judy emails and says, in Hayward, there's all kinds of yellow jackets. Found them killing butterflies and caterpillars in their yard. We're keeping our one-year-old inside because they're low to the ground patrolling. They seem more aggressive than usual as well. My husband found a nest under a planter, another one in a pile of pine needles, only about 10 feet away from the first. Also had a nest on a trail in our backyard my son happened to step on. Luckily, my husband and I got the 9 stings. And not our son. They even followed us into the house as we ran away from them. Is this the German yellow jacket?
Probably not. German yellow jacket is a little bit more of an urban critter, so it likes bigger cities. But we have native yellow jackets that live in similar environments. And so, you know, if I don't know if it's Eastern yellow jacket or one of the other species. One of the differences, they tend not to be as much scavengers compared to what German yellow jacket is, so less likely to be around a garbage can, I guess, is kind of a way to think of it. But, you know, it's interesting. Last year, I had kind of similar observations about the yellow jackets being somewhat quiet down here, and I did get some people tell me that up north that they found it was kind of the opposite. And I don't get as many reports from up north, so there definitely could be some places in the state that would have what I'd consider normal. Because like I said, when the yellow jackets are bad, it's the 1st of August and it's miserable until the frosts come. It would be best to spot treat those nests, those ground nests. I would use a dust, 7 garden dust is the easiest way to do it. And you know, what makes that more efficient is you're taking them out by the hundreds at a time rather than these yellow jacket traps that only take a few. I think I'd be most cautious eating and drinking outdoors during daylight hours, because these things are scavengers for protein and sugar, and that's what often draws them to people.
Nick in Green Bay, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I got a small problem with yellow jackets, and I heard your other caller, you said not to seal up the exit hole for them.
Right.
But my dog's really trying to chew on them and stuff, and that's the reason that I found them. And what I did was I drilled a hole for my image radio coax to go through the wall, and I sealed up the inside, and I didn't think about the outside. And the dogs started chewing at it or, like, pawing at it, and all of a sudden bees started coming out, so they put duct tape on there in July. Are they still going to be alive?
No,
or are they pretty much dead?
You would have seen activity. Well, one of two things. Either they find another way out, and you would have observed that within a couple, 3 days, or they would have been driven in. And so if you saw nothing going on 2 to 3 days after you did that treatment, they're done. You know, they
yeah, because they're pretty mad at me, and they're, like, trying to chew through the tape, but...
Yeah.
Couldn't get through the duct tape, so.
Well, you know, that's the problem, I have had, and as you go later in the season, the colonies get bigger, and I have had people who have caulked an opening, and then they've literally eaten their way out through wallboard, you can hear them in there. And so, as I said, that's why typically, if they're in a site that is problematic, I often suggest just treat them. You know, as I said, blow some dust in the entrance. Then once you make sure they're dead, you can seal up the openings. But it does just get a little risky, because... You know, sometimes, too, you will plug a nest that's very low in the house, and they end up showing up in the second floor bedroom. But, you know, they have access through the walls. And once they come out, they're attracted to light to some degree. And so again, they're coming through electrical outlets and in light fixtures in the ceiling. And so they said, I just really rather have them come out from one spot and deal with that and be done with it rather than taking a risk of driving them into places that you really can't treat.
Thanks, Nick, for calling. Tom in Janesville will give you a chance now. Hi, Tom.
Listen, my house is being invaded by millipedes. They're mostly in the kitchen. I have an attached garage that has a door, you know, into the kitchen. And we'll pick up maybe 10 to 20 of them in the course of a night running around the kitchen floor. And I've never had that experience before, and I don't know what the life cycle of these things are, where they might be coming from.
Well, I mean, millipedes are animals that live in the soil and feed on decaying organic matter, and usually they behave themselves, but it's not unusual in the late summer and early fall that they go through a migratory phase. It happens at night, so they're out cruising at night, and when the sun comes up, they will tend to try to accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark, so cement slabs are notorious for this. And coming indoors is a dead end on their part because it's too dry, there's nothing to eat, but they don't know that, and so people often will get this kind of migration inside that is quite a nuisance, but that's all it is, so that's the good news. Now, where they're coming from, I find that there's not enough organic matter in lawn grass that it's not a manicured lawn, but if you've got bark mulch around the house, or where I get more problems, the biggest problems are usually people that have large fields next to them that are filled, you know, with prairie-like grass or CRP fields where there's a lot of accumulated organic matter for the millipedes to feed on, and then they migrate from there. And knowing that, you can almost set up your line of defense out at the exterior perimeter of your property. You know, if I knew that the area that had the most organic matter was to the north, I would put a band of insecticide, whether granular or spray, 8 to 10 feet wide from where the lawn stops getting mowed, up against that area. Now, people do the same thing around their house, and what I find what doesn't work there is they just crawl through the pesticide and die in your house, and you still got a problem. And yeah. So to me, again, is to try to think of where they are. It's got to be a place that is got a lot of organic matter, thatch, those kinds of plant buildup, and then they will migrate through. If it's your bark mulch, then fine. You can treat your bark mulch with a, you know, hose end sprayer type of garden insecticide to try to knock it down. The other thing I tell people is look at your door sweeps and other things to make sure they fit tight enough so that critters can't squeeze through very easily.
All right. Thank you for calling. Jamie in Colfax, on to you. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good.
Afternoon. I just got a curiosity question more so. I see a fly. I do believe it's a fly. It's about midsummer, so almost looks like a piece of fluff, like floating in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious about what it is.
We've, in the last couple of years, there are a number of creatures we call woolly aphids, but there's one in particular called the woolly alder aphid that jumps between alder and maple trees, and it looks like a little piece of flying cotton candy might be the best way to describe it. And I've had a number of calls, and I bet you that's what you had is one of these adult alder aphids that was out cruising around. And, you know, on the maple trees, they're also referred to as a maple blight aphid. And I have in my career seen a couple times where they're numerous enough to cause a lot of stickiness and yellowing and leaf drop. But normally they're really a minor issue. They're not a plant issue. They're, again, more of a curiosity. The other one that I just received a photo image last week of, there are woolly aphids quite commonly on things like crab apples and whatnot in this time of the year. And they accumulate on the bark rather than on the leaves. And don't really pose the tree much problem. The only problem with some of these aphids in the fall that if you crush them, they leave kind of a purplish stain. And so I always tell people that there's one on willow, in fact, too. This one isn't fuzzy, but I've been seeing a couple samples come in the lab. And so this time of the year, you know, what's going on in our plants usually is not significant as far as the plant health. But again, be careful with some of these things because, as I said, if you go out crushing these things or whatnot, sometimes you'll get some unpleasant stains on things.
All right. Thanks again for calling. Liz in Janesville emailed us, noticed a Japanese beetle on her beetles on her hollyhock blossoms this year, although she didn't detect any damage. She wants to plant some more hollyhocks, but wants to make sure she won't attract more beetles and potential damage to her yard.
Boy, that's going to be a very difficult one because hollyhock is up in that upper 10% of things they like to eat because we know they like to eat everything, but that, you know, is... In Janesville is an area where it has had significant Japanese beetle populations for quite some time. So, you know, I can tell you that you can plant them in somewhat more of a shady area and they'll get somewhat less problems. But unless you want to get into the high maintenance of spraying the plants on a almost weekly to 10-day basis, I don't know any way of stopping them from coming in, because, again, they are so good at picking up on their preferred plants. And, again, in a lot of these areas where they've been established, there's just so many beetles around. And in hollyhock, I'm surprised. If they really were serious, they would have done significant chewing and skeletonizing of the leaves aside from the flowers. I mean, they really do lace them up quite a bit.
Daryl in Phillips has some property for 30 years and over that time has had an infestation of red black ants that bite. They're not afraid, and when we get in their territory, they stand up and fight, crawl on us and bite us. Years ago, we were told the only thing was DDT to get rid of them. Of course, you can't use that. That's banned. And we've tried numerous pesticides over the years, still don't get rid of them. Is there somewhere we can send one of these ants to have it identified, maybe, or any other ideas?
Well, I'd happy to look at it, but I know it's one of the Formica field ants, just the way it's behaving. And the problem with these is those colonies can live for 10 or 12 years. And the queen, which is the mother of all these ants, is down in the ground. And if you kill the queen, you win. If you don't kill the queen, you still have ants. And the biggest mistake that most people make is they treat the upper surface of it, and they kill a few ants, and the ants stop coming to the top. But within 2 weeks or 2 months, they're still active again because you haven't killed the colony. It's going to be a little bit labor-intensive, but you have to spot treat every nest. And what I do with these kind of nests is go out there with a metal bar or rod and poke three or four good holes into the center of the nest and push down as far as you can push reasonably. So you're often going 18 to 24 inches or more, and then you mix up your chemical. And to be honest, the garden insecticide 7 is as good as anything else, and I mix it up in a bucket. And it may take a gallon, and in a huge nest, it may take 2 gallons of dilute product, and you drench it on so it soaks way down deep. And what you're doing then is much more likely getting it down to the queen. Once you kill her, you have solved the problem. And the trouble is if you've got a large acreage and you've got 50 mounds, that's a lot of time and effort.
Yeah.
But that is the only way I know to treat them. And again, it's all about getting stuff penetrating. And I find if you drench this 2 gallons on the upper surface, it doesn't go near as deep. But when you put these channels in and allow it to really penetrate there, you'll have much better success.
Rachel in Appleton has a question for you. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I was wondering if you could give me any suggestions. I've recently moved into my house and have tiny flies or small flies that are coming out of the drain.
Boy, I hope my wife's not listening. there is a critter called a drain fly. And drain flies tend to breed where you have some moisture in organic matter. And typically, what I find is a hot pail of water in the proper drain will often solve the problem. Or secondly, if you can get rid of that scummy stuff. And in our household, it is an annual late summer problem. And I have cleaned out all the bathroom overflow cuts. I have flushed the shower drain. I have done everything that I would tell people to do. And I haven't found the site yet. And it drives us both kind of crazy. As long as you know where this in the basement, floor drains are notorious for having the problem because we don't flush that much water through. Whereas I'd say your kitchen sink drain, there's no way because there's so much going through there all the time. You don't get this accumulation in the bathroom in overflow cuts in sinks. You know, it does get wet and cruddy, but often you don't see stuff go through. So as I said, I often tell people to try to clean those out as best they can. If that's the site. Now, sometimes it's obvious. If all the critters are in the basement, you know it's the basement floor drain. If all the critters are in the bathroom, you know the source is in the bathroom. What's driving me crazy at home is I can find them in the kitchen. I can find them in any one of our 2 bathrooms. And as I said, with all my years of being an entomologist, I have yet to been able to find one maggot. And if I found one maggot, I'd have the secret of where the source is. And it hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
But hot water should solve it?
Yeah, good hot water. Much better than bleach. People give bleach far much too credit. What it does is it just sterilizes the outer part of the scum and it doesn't kill stuff. In fact, we take live insects and dip them in bleach to sterilize them when we're doing experiments and they live through it just fine. If the problem is an accumulation of organic matter, I think you're better to get a biodigester, you know, something that will slowly eat the scum and flush it rather than going with the caustic stuff like Drano and whatnot, which, again, to me, doesn't necessarily solve the problem. I said in institutional settings, we find these biodigesters a little slower to work, but ultimately a lot better because it eats through all that scum and then the water will flush it away and then you don't have a food reservoir and you're done.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Another email from this time from Mary from Cedarburg. She was lucky enough to witness a major cicada hatch in her yard. She says, I got great photos from the hatch until they flew away. While shooting one cicada as it emerged from its shell, it was suddenly attacked by maybe a wasp. After a short while, as you can see in the photo, it looks as though it's crying a tear. Although I wanted to shoo the monster away, I just kept taking pictures. What do you think?
Okay, yeah. Well, this is another one of these. The governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. You know, we talked about the praying mantids earlier. Early in my career, I never saw cicada killers, which is this big giant cicada wasp. And I bet you that's what it was. And they literally will sting the cicada and paralyze it, you know, so it can't move. And then they drag it along and drop it in their burrows. And I bet you that's what she witnessed as a cicada killer. And as I said, if you would have got a hold of me 25 years ago and asked, I would have been scratching my head a little bit because that's an Indiana insect. It doesn't belong here. But the way things are, it doesn't surprise me. They're up in Cedarburg. And again, they're one of... I mean, birds and other things feed on cicadas. They have all kinds of things that take advantage of them. But cicada killers, that's the only thing. And we had a ton of them on campus this year.
Oh.
Really pretty docile, but they're big enough to scare people. It's the biggest wasp you'll see in this state.
Let's see. We've got Gary in Ettrick up next. Gary, hello.
Hello. It seems like you had a number of bee questions already, but I've got another one.
Okay.
About a month ago, there was just this loud buzzing in our yard, and we've got a willow tree out front, and there are just thousands of bees, a couple different kinds, hovering around and landing on the branches, and there seems to be some little black specks all over the tree. And we had a bee guy look at him, and he said, we got a couple different kinds of hornets, but mostly yellow jackets, just thousands of them. Now, they haven't been aggressive. We go stand in there, but are they going to get aggressive? They seem to be diminishing a little.
Sure.
Well, what can we
do? The thing about that is that yellow jackets, you know, make paper wasp type nest, and you don't have a nest because you would see it. But the black things, I have a feeling you've got aphids, or if you don't have aphids, you have scale. And either one of those insects secrete a sugary water substance as they feed. And various yellow jackets in wasps go after that. And so the reason they're feeding on the tree is it's a restaurant as far as they're concerned. Huh. And then, of course, as the aphid numbers go down, there's less food and you'll see less yellow jackets. But this is a good way of getting some feel about what their temperament is like. If there's a nest around and it's threatened, they're very aggressive. But when they're not around a nest, when they're just out feeding, they really are quite docile. And so their temperament being, you know, not aggressive fits very much with just their feeding pattern. The options I give people in this case is that, you know, if this was next to a pool or, you know, your backyard picnic bench, if you were to take care of the insects that are feeding on the tree, there's no longer any sugar water and there'd be no longer any wasps. And again, there is a large black aphid on willow, and we call it a willow, giant willow aphid that I suspect was secreting this honeydew or sugar water that the wasps were taking advantage of. This late in the game, though, I don't think I'd mess with them. I think I'd just let things
go. We're having about 100 people are better open over in a week and a half and eating outside. I'm just worried that all of a sudden they're going to show up or something.
Well, they won't. If the aphid numbers are down, they just won't be there. There's no reason to be there. If you had to spray
the... I'm going to be pretty good in a week and a half.
Yeah, I would think. We're within that point of time that most of my insects are getting ready for the winter and not worrying so much about eating. But if they were still there, to be honest, even spraying the tree with soapy water or going to buy some of this insecticidal soap that you get at the garden store would take care of the aphids, and then very quickly the wasps will stop coming.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Phil, in the last minute, are there any more sightings of the emerald ash borer or any other locations?
Not in Wisconsin, although the Department of Ag is busy delineating the infestation right now, trying to get a handle on that, but we've seen no new ones. I think the one that I have been most disappointed about was the positive up in Houghton, Michigan, or the county of Houghton, which is up in the UP. The population we've known about, they had a couple little hits over in the Mackinac Island area, but this is far on the western edge.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, if indeed it's, and I don't know how bad that one is. Again, it often takes really a couple months of really going out and digging to get a good handle on how big these infestations are. But, you know, ultimately that one will be more problematic, I think, to control than in our more urban settings where we at least have a chance. You know, there are trees in people's backyards and we can do something about it.
Phil, always a pleasure. You'll be back again soon, I hope, in a month or so.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension Entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab in the College of Ag and Life Sciences on the Madison campus. I'm really pleased to have him with us. Tomorrow, we'll be taking a look at the coal-fired plant proposal for Cassville, and with a couple of different viewpoints. Barbara Swan, president of Wisconsin Power and Lights, one of our guests. The other guest, Peter Taglia, of Clean Wisconsin. So that's up tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.